This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
And welcome to the Monopoly Money edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. We have a very special guest. We have an amazing show lined up. This is going to be a really fun one, mostly because we have an amazing special guest, but also because we're going to be talking about demonetization, and any excuse to use the word demonetization is something you should jump at. We are going to talk about fake news and algorithms because Cathy O'Neill, the data scientist and author of Weapons of Math Destruction, is here. And whenever there's an algorithm in the news, Cathy, what do?
I fucking destroy it.
The answer is you talk about it on Slate Money.
I do.
Cathy O'Neill, destroyer of algorithms, conqueror of worlds.
We have Jordan Weissman, of course, from Slate.
I've never fully destroyed an algorithm in my life, sadly.
I am Felix Salmon of Fusion, and I wrote a big article about algorithms once. What was it called, Jesse?
The formula that killed Wall Street.
Completely
committed your oeuvre to memory.
expected Jesse to whip out your fucking greatest.
I do
hits.
Remember the article. It was a wonderful piece.
Should we introduce Jesse?
Oh, and of course, there is the one and only Jesse Eisinger.
Thank you very much. I thought I needed no introduction.
but just for the three listeners who need to know who are you?
I am a reporter at ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative news organization.
And you are an investigative journalist.
I am in the flesh.
And you have investigated. What have you investigated? You just published this doorstopper of an article. You sent me the PDF the night before, and it was like 13 pages. And I was like, wow, this is a big article.
Well, you just have to read the first four paragraphs. That's what most people do, or just the tweets, you know.
All 13 pages are excellent.
Thank you so much.
I especially like page 11.
That was the best. That's my favorite page, too.
What's the subject of the article?
Oh, the subject of the article is professors who help sell mergers secretly at the government level, producing reports that are often gamed.
So we are journalists here in this room, with the possible exception of Cathy. And one of the things which all journalists know is that if you ever want someone important sounding to come up with a certain opinion, you can always find a professor somewhere who will have that opinion. And it's quite easy to, like, you know, there's thousands and thousands of professors around the country on any subject you want. And if you want some expert to give you a certain opinion, it's quite easy to find an expert at some university somewhere who will have that opinion. And in journalism, this is a bit of a game which journalists play because they feel like they can't put their own opinions into articles, so they need to phone someone up and get an opinion from them. At the level of antitrust and monopolies and mergers, this is These are questions of national import, and yet basically exactly the same thing is happening.
And it's economics professors for the most part, right?
Yes. So what we're talking about here is, economics professors or a specialized field of economics, merger economics, antitrust economics, called the jargon is industrial organizations economists. And yes, they are selling their opinions to corporations for millions of dollars, and they produce reports that justify the mergers when the companies go to get approval from the Department of Justice or the Federal Trade Commission for the mergers, because that the government
and
has
the
to
idea is
things.
that because they can claim to be a grand tenured professor at such and such a university, their opinion carries more weight. So they continue their professorships at such and such university, which are probably paying them $200,000 or something, even though the overwhelming majority of their income comes from working on these antitrust cases.
Exactly. They are leveraging the academic reputations of their – or weaponizing the academic reputations of their institutions for corporate and personal gain.
I'm going to jump in here and mention that it's not just an opinion, really. What we're talking about here are models.
Exactly.
They're models that, as you point out in your brilliant article, are not vetted by the public. They're like secret. And they're also not held accountable. Like once they come true or don't come true, depending on how the antitrust decision works out, it seems like people don't go back and see whether their opinions, their modeled opinions, come true or not.
Exactly. So we expect academics to, and when journalists are calling up academics, we're expecting them to give intellectually honest answers. Yes, journalists are maybe shopping around for opinions, but we're expecting the professors to have come to those opinions through work and intellectual honesty. But in fact, what's happening here is the corporations hire the economists. The economists produce their models. And the models are, as you say, not seen by the public or other academics. These are not published in peer-reviewed journals. They just go to the government, and the government and the companies and the economists hash them out secretly. There's no there's really no public vetting at all of this process. Sometimes they go to court, but the documents are often sealed by judges, even when they go to court, public court. And then the government, for a variety of reasons, never checks 3 years, 6 years on to see whether the embedded predictions of these econometric models actually turned out to be true. What they're saying, just to finish very quickly, is they're saying these mergers will not be bad for consumers, will not be bad for the economy. They will not raise prices. And so they have these embedded predictions, and we have no idea whether they turn out to be true.
So Kathy has written a great book, which talks in large part about the models of evaluating teachers and this kind of thing, all of these kind of models. And one of the problems that Kathy finds endemically around the world is this idea that models have to iterate. You have your model, and then you put it into the world, and then something happens in the world, and your model makes a prediction, and then you test your prediction against what actually happens in the world, and then you use the actual outcome in the world to improve your model. And unless you are having that feedback loop, it seems that there is a huge level of sort of intellectual dishonesty and secrecy and unhelpful secrecy and counterproductive secrecy going on. And that seems to be exactly what's going on here, that no one is really intellectually, honestly iterating their models in light of real world effects.
Yes. And the reason is that it's not in corporate interests to do so, because it would possibly make mergers less that it would possibly make the government approve fewer mergers, and these companies want to merge. So there's an obvious reason why that's not happening. The government could potentially do this, could vet the models, could make them public, do all sorts of things like that, but they don't.
Part of the reason is this wonderful revolving door.
Part of the reason is the revolving door, where top government officials, both economists and lawyers, revolve into law and go back to their universities and their consulting firms. and then work for corporations. So I think that's a big part of it. And the other part is that they would need legislation, and Congress isn't in the mood to strengthen antitrust enforcement. And let's be clear, from what we can tell from academic research, these mergers are hurting the American economy, that prices actually do go up more than expected from all this these merger waves that have happened over the last 30 years. American corporations are more concentrated now than they were at any time since the Gilded Age, and that may be contributing. Economists are starting to think it's contributing to wealth inequality, corporate profits that are far exceeding wage increases, business innovation is stagnant. Small business formation is low. We're having all sorts of ills that in part can be attributed to corporate concentration.
But one of the businesses which is booming is this consulting business.
Yeah. So one of the things I really kind of liked about this article is it kind of cuts to one of the kind of fundamental lies, I think, that has been sold about antitrust policy for the past 30 years, which was there was this idea early on, and especially in the 80s, and you talk about that antitrust should be based in sort of some economic science, right? That was the goal, was you're going to make all this less ideological, less about just promoting, quote, competition for competition's sake, and you were going to bring the economists in to make this, to make our you know, enforcement rational and efficient. And as time's gone on, you talk about how these consulting firms that these economists work for will be hired by both sides of a problem. You can see how, depending on who's paying them, they'll come up with a different answer, essentially.
Right.
And you get that demonstrated that these guys are paid about $500 to $1,000 an hour, and it's pretty clear they're being paid to come up with a specific answer. They're guns for hire. And so that really just kind of undermines this whole question of, it's like, okay, how scientific can any of this ever have been? That is, and I think that's something that you have to kind of wonder then, how do we, knowing that it's never really science, how do you reorient antitrust?
I have an idea.
Yeah.
It comes from a Doctor Who episode I watched with my kids the other day. Doctor Who, like, somehow used his powers to make peace. Like, there was humans against some kind of aliens, and they were negotiating for peace. And Doctor Who made them, like, temporarily forget whether they were aliens or whether they were humans. And, like, for the next 3 hours, you have to negotiate for peace, and you actually don't know which side you're on. And it was pretty interesting. I was wondering if we could do this with these antitrust cases where we make a pool of money that the government and the corporations who have interest in it are both contributing to, and then the people who are hired don't know who they're working for. Is that possible?
Oh, that's interesting. So
that's great. It's a great idea. I mean,
and that's actually not that dissimilar.
It's kind of arbitration
I have
in a way.
But really bizarre personal interest in this, because my grandfather's last job was as a member of the Monopolies and Mergers Commission in the United Kingdom.
There you go.
And the mergers would come to his committee for approval. And that was basically what they did. They didn't see themselves as judges who would get a position from one side and a position from the other side and then have to come up with their own decision. They just, you know, used their own expertise and came to their own decisions. But you're right that they probably had their own priors. I think that if you just told these experts who are making lots of money and continue to pay them lots of money if that's what they need, to just come up with one opinion, but just don't tell them who they're working for, that would be the question. Is, I think, as Jesse has demonstrated, there are experts who generally find that things are never anti-competitive. And then there are other experts who generally find that things are always anti-competitive. And so it just pushes the problem back one level to, well, now there's which also, expert are you hiring?
There's also the question of politics, right?
Because, right, exactly.
You know, if you have a Democratic administration administering that, this idea of, like, a, you know, neutral group of experts, the neutral group of experts are they're probably going to pick neutral experts who are going to find that these mergers hurt competition. And if it's a Republican administration, they're probably going to kind of lean towards experts who are going to want to push and approve these mergers. And we've seen that in your article. You talk about how sometimes in the George W. Bush administration, the people in charge of antitrust at Justice rejected their own staff's recommendations on this stuff and said, go ahead. Even if we're finding that this is probably going to be anti-competitive, I don't care.
There is really no such thing as neutral.
Exactly. Probably. And the economists have sort of sold us on this idea, and it's a bad bad assumption because they make all sorts of unseen assumptions about the world, and also the field is makes general has sort of general beliefs. So even people on the kind of pro enforcement side of antitrust accept a bunch of notions about the way the economists see the world that we shouldn't necessarily accept. I'll give you one example, which is so over the last 40 years, as the economists have taken over the field, we have now distilled the question of corporate power to just the question of whether consumers are benefiting or not, because that's the thing that economists can measure. And so they judge things on what they can measure. But of course, we consider, and the people who framed the antitrust laws 100 years ago considered corporate power in and of itself to be dangerous because it could distort our politics.
And
we don't measure that.
Yeah. Well. And this is, I think, also, one of the problems here is that it only this entire mechanism only really creaks into existence when there is a merger. And what you have is a bunch of very powerful monopolies in this country, a lot of them relatively young, like Google and Facebook. There's Microsoft, there's Uber. And these powerful monopolies are incredibly profitable, and because they were not created through mergers, there's no one really regulating them as monopolies.
Well, I'll make two points of that. That's absolutely right, except for one thing is that a lot of these guys are products of small mergers. So Facebook buys Instagram, which makes it extremely powerful. But the way our antitrust enforcement works, we measure that and we say, well, Instagram doesn't have that much profit and it'll actually help consumers because they're giving away things for free. So we don't have mechanisms to understand those kind of mergers. The other thing is that we actually do have laws, anti-monopoly laws, and Microsoft was prosecuted under monopoly laws. It's called Section 2 in the Department of Justice because you can't do anti-competitive things as a monopoly. Monopolies are legal, but certain corporate behavior, if you're a monopoly, is not legal. And we can prosecute that, but the Obama administration, which came in with a lot of making a lot of noise about reviving anti-monopoly prosecutions and enforcement, didn't do anything. They did one insignificant
move. Other BFFs with Google, too.
And they are in bed with Silicon Valley and Google and Facebook and Uber. And so this is part of the kind of elite democratic complicity that gave rise to he shall not be named.
Okay, so
your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company, and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
On which depressing note, Kathy?
Yeah.
Since we're talking about Google and Facebook.
Yeah.
Talk about Google and Facebook.
Well, I have to say, this it's a big topic, but what we're going to talk about is like the fake news phenomenon on Google and Facebook, and the extent to which people are starting to, well, are not starting to, are claiming that it swung the election for Trump, that fake news, especially on the right, it was very influential, especially in the last 3 months of the election. I think the fake news actually did better on Facebook than actual
news.
This is
the fascinating BuzzFeed report that came out this week. They saw the most successful and most shared news articles on Facebook were fake news. And inevitably, fake news means like right-wing anti-Hillary news. And for the past couple months, that was much bigger than any of the real news.
So the question is, like, first of all, how influential is it? And the answer is we don't know because it's hard to measure that and Facebook isn't sharing their data. And then the second question is, what should Facebook do about that? And I would argue that it's actually just kind of an extreme case of something that's a much bigger problem. And the much bigger problem, which people know about, is just sort of the echo chamber aspects of social media in general.
But let's stick with the fake news because the news hook here is that both Facebook and Google, after having made unknown amounts of money during the election on political advertising and from news sites and from fake news sites who've been trying to seed these fake news articles by buying advertising on Facebook and Google, both of them came out after the election when it was too late and said, oh, we're going to no longer accept advertising from these sites. And so if you're a Moldovan teenager putting together a bunch of fake alt-right news stories, you can still put those on the internet and people on Facebook can still share them, but you can't buy Facebook ads which sponsor them.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the Facebook cutting them off from ads seems like a more minor thing than Google doing it, right? Because AdSense really, I mean, making it harder to promote the stories using Facebook ads obviously makes it a little bit more difficult for them to go viral, but they still can just through their own natural, you know, catchy fake newsiness. But AdSense is actually the bigger one, it seems here. It's like saying, okay, this is their revenue stream. So it makes it less lucrative
to
go and do it.
So they get a whole bunch of traffic to their fake news stories, but if they can't monetize that traffic, then there's no point. And the way they monetize that traffic is by serving Google ads, basically.
Yeah, it's unclear. One guy gave an interview to the Washington Post who runs he thinks of it as sort of a higher class fake news site. He calls it satire. And he's actually, it's fascinating if you find it. He's this dude who just feels extremely guilty because now he thinks he may have actually helped swing the election for Trump, even if that wasn't his intention. He was just trying to clown the guy's supporters, basically, and make, you know, $10,000 a month doing it off AdSense. But even he thinks that maybe he'll be able to continue making a living, that this isn't really going to cut him off. So the guys who do this are possibly more resilient than, you know, the initial, than they're resilient folks. They're going to find ways around this, or they think they will.
I mean, even just the Facebook and Google coming out and saying they're going to take a stand on this is a huge cultural shift because, it isn't a cultural shift yet. But my theory is that they won't actually be able to follow through with this promise until they come up with a definition of what's fake. And that's really, really something they've tried to avoid for the last 10 years.
Right. It does sort of frighten me, the prospect of these giant Silicon Valley monopolies trying to make judgments about speech. And this is where I've been very torn about the Twitter debate, about all the trolling, anti-Semitism, racism. I mean, it's obviously appalling that people have to put up with that. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I want Twitter making decisions about what they block and what they don't block.
So Twitter has been blocking known ISIS accounts. There's been this kind of whack-a-mole thing where ISIS accounts have sprung up and then Twitter has closed them down and they've sprung up and closed down for years now. And then much more recently in the past couple of weeks, they've started closing down a whole bunch of alt-right accounts as well. Not because of the reason they closed down Milo's account, which was the harassment and the just beyond over the line behavior, but just because they are members of these sort of hateful groups. And yeah, I can see issues when you have something which approximates a public utility like Google or Facebook or Twitter for these big private, unaccountable companies to make their own determinations about what's acceptable. Obviously, they have every legal right to do that, but it is a little bit scary.
I mean, a few months ago, I think it was Facebook banned the famous picture of the little girl in Vietnam who was a victim of a napalm raid. We don't want them doing that. And having these people making these judgments, it worries me, although objectively speaking, all of this hateful harassment is obviously appalling and disgusting.
I don't think we can avoid it. I mean, look, these companies have made their money based on this assumption that everything in the world can be turn into an algorithm. But the truth of the matter is, and we just discussed this in the last segment, algorithms are not neutral. There are embedded values in it. And so the question is, like, which values? And they have to choose, they have to, like, at the end of the day, and I've been getting all these emails from all my data nerd friends saying, here's what Facebook should do algorithmically to solve this problem. None of them are going to work. You actually have to have humans that make judgments at the end of the day, or we're just going to leave it the way it is.
So when you said there was part of a broader problem, then you went on to say about social media echo chamber, I thought you were going to say something different, which is it's a part of a broader problem of fake news in this country, because I think the biggest purveyor of fake news in this country is Fox.
You see, and that is exactly why you should not be in charge of determining what is fake news. But I think,
Black Panther Party was not.
But the way I see it is stealing votes. We are getting our news now through AMP pages and Facebook instant articles and various other things which look good on phones. And the thing that they all have in common is that they all look the same. That once upon a time, you would watch a newscast on a certain channel, you would pick up one newspaper as opposed to another newspaper, you would tune to one part of the radio dial rather than another, and you would get a set of news stories from that one bundle, and you would trust that one bundle. And even if, and what's more, you would wind up receiving news from that one bundle, even which you didn't know you wanted to get, but just because you would read the whole bundle, and some of it would be more interesting and some of it would be less. With the unbundling and social mediaization of news, what we have is that you're only reading the stories you want to read, and that the branding of the organization that has created the news story has never been less important. So if you're reading a news story, which is AMP or Facebook Instant Article, it's very easy to not know or not see or not care where that story came from. And so it becomes much, much easier for people to digest and believe fake news. And about 15 years ago, a friend of mine was teaching literacy in New York public schools, and he was like, these are kids who have grown up on the internet, and this is pre-phones, but it was still like post-internet, and he was like, go on the internet and find stuff and tell me what's true. And he found that the kids who had grown up on the internet were surprisingly bad at being able to distinguish between truth and falsity online. That if it was on the internet, they just believed it.
Yeah.
And I think that that syndrome has now expanded to the entire country, and that the entire country is getting its news from the internet and has no real ability to tell the difference between what's true and what's false.
I also want to come back to this kind of idea of false neutrality, right? As long as you are serving people, like Facebook's algorithm is designed to serve people a certain kind of news, that is a slant. That is a slant in their algorithm. It's saying, okay, you're going to get X kind of thing. And that is making a determination about what people read and can't and aren't going to read in their day. So every decision they make is going to be toying with what information people consume. And at that point, you have to, I think, say, wash your hands and saying, oh, well, it's neutral. It's just because other people are deciding it. So, like, well, your algorithm lets other people decide it. So I'm just basically elaborating on your earlier point, but I think it is the core one. Every time they come back to their defense, they come back to neutrality as a defense, it's like, it's fake neutrality.
And it's not even neutral, because what they're doing is they're putting their thumb on the scale very, very hard in favor of the most sensational news articles.
Yeah. Because, well, actually, those, are the ones, news articles
because
well.
Those are the ones which get the most engagement and most shares. And right. the algorithms are designed to surface the articles which get the most engagement and
right.
most shares.
Right. So I would argue, okay, so I'm going to take the side of Facebook for just a second. I know that's impossible, but Facebook would argue, hey, we are giving people what they want, and we're defining, we're using the proxy of what they want by what they click on, what they engage on in, and what they share. And the problem is that people have, this is a pretty bad proxy of what people actually want in a long-term way. People actually probably want to read news that they trust from a trusted news source like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or something. But what they actually click on are like pictures of Kim Kardashian and listicles. And so there's that skew there.
Yeah,
and that skew propagates and creates the news world in its own image. Yeah. And so I would argue that it's even if you give Facebook the benefit of the doubt, that they're not trying to put their thumb on a scale, their choice of poor proxy for what people actually want is having this incredibly negative effect.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's the instant gratification. It's the difference between when people think about what they want. They want to lose weight, right? But
yes.
in the moment, they want the cookie too. They want
it's
two
like
different
being,
things,
it's like
and which
being
is Facebook going to cater to?
Surrounded by cookies when you're trying to be on it.
All the time. No, absolutely. That is what Facebook's news environment is.
When we had broadcast networks and people worried that TV was a vast wasteland, we had regulation, government intervention that required them to do things like provide public broadcasting, to fund, to have equal time for politicians, to so that there was some requirement to offset their monopolization of the broadcast, or, you know, oligopoly of the broadcast airwaves with information that served the public good. Maybe we need to regulate Twitter and Facebook and Google so that they provide that too.
Is equal time, is that like, does that apply to Fox News?
No, they're cable, so.
They oh, so it's only network news.
Yeah, although I think it's been eroded now over the years.
I want that to expand to everywhere.
Right, and so the cable news has to produce C-SPAN.
Yeah. I'm not saying it would solve every problem, but that is a problem.
I don't know if equal time is opposed to equal time. Yeah. I think it's a bad idea in general.
Another conversation.
But that's, that's another conversation. We have something much more interesting to come on to.
Deep mono.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Jordan.
Yes.
What we have is a right-wing, disruptive president being elected to come in and make massive, unexpected, sweeping changes that no government would ever dream of making.
To possibly drain the swamp, you might even say.
to drain the swamp. And we are talking about, of course, about Narendra Modi.
Yeah, of course. We're talking about the Prime Minister of India. Who did you think we might be talking about?
How's that going?
Okay, so Modi was elected partly on a little background. He was elected largely on this platform of ending corruption in India, which is an endemic problem there. There's just huge black market economy. There's all kinds of, you know, palm greasing and just all kinds of skullduggery in government. And so he was going to fight this. And then he hasn't really done a lot, except about a week ago, he made a surprise announcement. He just got on the air at 8 p.m. and said, at midnight tonight, all 500,000 rupee notes are no longer going to be legal tender. Just no more in this country. They will be worthless. And you now have, you know, X amount of time to go and exchange these notes to get, you know, other denominations of cash. But What?
It's not even cash. You have X amount of time to take them to the bank and deposit them in your bank account where it becomes electronic money, which can be taxed.
Yeah, that to get a lot.
And to add to that, if it exceeds a certain amount of money, you will be investigated.
Yes.
If it's more than 250,000 rupees, then we're going to start raising an eyebrow and saying, where did all of this money magically come from?
Exactly.
Do they care about the black market per se, or do they just care about tax avoidance?
Well, so just to give a little extra context for this, this is about 86% of the circulating cash in India. We're talking about
these, by value.
These two notes are make up. So, I mean, we're talking about a massive disruption in India, in Indian life. And suddenly what you've gotten is now, well, you know, long lines of people queuing up to try and go hand in their money and freaking out, and total disruption of rural economies that essentially...
ATMs running dry
because they can't even replace them with new notes. I mean, it seems to have been very little planning, and especially in the rural economy, this is problematic because it's almost an entirely cash economy already, and these were the notes. And so what you're getting is people are still trading in these 1,000 and 500 rupee notes, but they're trading at a discount. And all kinds of things are just going haywire. And
so India is a fascinating country from a payments perspective, because it actually has arguably the most sophisticated electronic payments infrastructure in the world.
Yeah, for part of the population, though.
Well, actually, for most of the population. Like, there's this national identification number, which you get when you're born.
Yeah.
And along with the national identification number, there's a bank account. So really, every Indian gets a bank account at birth. And the ability to transfer money from one bank account to another bank account is instant. It doesn't take 3 days like it does in the United States. It takes 3 seconds. And India has made a very, very concerted attempt to try and basically move everyone off of cash, which has a huge number of problems associated with it, not just crime and corruption and that kind of stuff, but it's just an inefficient way of paying for things in general. And it is working very slowly, and these things don't happen overnight, but it seems like Narendra Modi really wants this to happen overnight.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, you're talking still about a country of like 600 million people or so, and I think it's still about half of them, even though they technically have a bank account, they're still unbanked. Right. Yeah, you know, it's still, you know, which is basically a population the size of the United States, unbanked. And now you're cutting into their cash in the name of, you know, stopping essentially black market transactions.
And given that, like, I looked at a couple articles from India about the long lines for the banks and the ATMs. And the people in those lines are just kind of like, yeah, this is a pain in the ass, but actually it might be worth it.
Well, it depends on who the people are.
Yeah.
And I think the first order effect of this has been what was intended to a large extent, which was that the undocumented, untaxed parts of the economy are feeling it worse. If you have a pile of millions of rupees worth of cash, and you don't have a bank account, or it's just a very small bank account, which the authorities would look at you askance if you suddenly deposited millions of dollars of cash into it, then you're going to be forced to either lose that money or pay huge amounts of tax on it.
Aren't the really corrupt and really wealthy people not keeping big piles of cash around.
So this goes up to probably the 98th percentile of the corrupt.
Right, so they're really powerful people.
The top 2% still have their Swiss bank accounts.
Have gold and have Swiss bank accounts.
Yeah.
And so you're really completely attacking essentially the wrong people.
Well, I mean, I think
tax avoiders who are not the big fish.
What it theoretically gets at is day-to-day corruption, right? Like small businesses that are just hoarding, you know, doing all cash under the table and not recording their profits, things like that. And that is a problem in India. You don't have enforcement of tax laws and accounting standards and that like you do in a Western a Western fully developed country.
It's a little bit like Mexico is one of my favorite examples of this, that there was a big attempt a few years ago to try and extend the income tax in Mexico. Mexico historically had like zero or very low income tax and quite a high level of income you needed before you ever started paying income tax. And you wound up getting most of the country not paying any taxes, which sounded like a wonderful idea in principle, especially when the country was getting billions of dollars in oil revenues from Pemex, the state oil company. Oil revenues then started falling, but more to the point, people realized that it was a good idea to have a relatively broad tax base. Even if the amount of tax collection is low, it creates a civil society to have people paying something into the system and to just be part of the system.
Or another way of saying that is if you have a cutoff, then it's like you have every incentive to avoid seeming to make that much money, right? So every dollar above that has got to be under the table.
I think also, you know, you have to kind of, again, separate intentions versus implementation here and what's going on in India. I mean, to give you a sense of like kind of the dysfunction that's unfolding. At the same time, they're demonetizing these 500,000 rupee notes. They've released a 2,000 rupee note. They've actually given, they're now creating a higher denomination, which no, like experts have been saying, it's a puzzle. I don't know why they're doing that. That should theoretically make it even easier for really high rollers to hide money. And so there is a world, I think, where they did that, where they would have done this and announced it and said, we're going to do this over time and we're going to demonetize and we're going to try to push people into the recorded electronic system. And that would have made a lot more sense. But they're calling this shock and awe. And it's not, it's no one's seems to have fully understand why Modi decided it this way.
This being India, the reason is uniquely and obviously Indian, which is that he's not just doing this to crack down on corruption and crime. He's also doing this to bash Pakistan. And so what he's doing is he's blaming Pakistan for what he claims to be a rash of fake 500,000 rupee notes. And so he's like, the evil Pakistanis will no longer be able to make money by printing up these fake banknotes, and they're not going to be able to fake the 2,000 rupee notes. So we are bashing Pakistan this way.
I also thought that it was actually like so that people who were not Swiss bank account corruption, but like just below that, wouldn't be able to hide their money right beforehand.
Theoretically, but I mean,
giving them advance notice.
Yeah, because there's no way of converting your black market 1,000 rupees into white market 2,000 rupee notes. Because then you need to do that via a bank. And once it hits the banking system, it becomes visible
but to people
the
are still authorities. People are still buying gold, which is always, and things like that, which in India is actually, I mean, that's always been
It's non-trivial to buy gold with 1,000 rupee notes.
I mean, yeah, and to give you a sense, I guess listeners a sense, I mean, a 1,000 rupee note is about $15. It's 14.70, I think, right now. So it's not non-trivial, but I mean, people are finding a way again.
But I'm saying the gold merchants aren't selling. If I'm a gold merchant and you come to me with a stack of 1,000 rupee notes and say, can I buy some gold? I'm going to be like, no, not really. Or if I do, it's going to be at a big discount.
Well, that's where you're getting the 20 to 60% discounts. Exactly. And that's...
So what could Modi do, going back to Jesse's comment? Like, what could Modi do to deal with those top 1%? I mean, like, I'm actually kind of like in awe of this. I feel like it's brash. Like,
I feel like, yeah, Jesse's being a little bit harsh. I mean, the problem of the international plutocrat Swiss bank account corrupt class is not an Indian problem. It's a global problem.
But really maybe Modi will actually address it.
Really, there's only one country in the world which manages to successfully tax all of its citizens on their global income. And we're living in it. It's the United States. No other country has solved this problem. And you know, there's been a lot of talk about bringing various regulatory regimes in accordance with each other and international banks and blah, 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 blah. But this is not something that can be done at the individual government level in India. This can only be done either at the global level or, interestingly, for U.S. citizens.
I think that overstates the American tax authorities' power here. But, I think that what you would want to do if you were Modi and you want is to make at least some nominal efforts to try to address the plutocrats as well, to sort of say we're going to share the pain. I mean, one of the things would be transparency on make new requirements for I don't know enough about it, but new requirements for disclosure of foreign assets and things like that.
So I feel like that's probably enough demonetization for one day. You know, it's a good word, but you don't want more than about 10 minutes of it. India has to live with it. So that's a whole other thing.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Let's have a numbers round, people. No. Who has a number?
I have a number.
What's your number?
50 million, which is the number of dollars expected by this guy. I'm trying to remember his name. Renaud Laplanche.
Renaud, my good old friend Renaud from Lending Club.
Yeah, so he got kicked out of Lending Club for various devious acts. And now he's started a new company called Credify, which is exactly the same thing as Lending Club. And he's expecting $50 million in revenue this year. That's to compare with 26 or maybe $29 billion in Lending Club last year. So it's small. But, you know, Lending Club started small, too. We'll see.
I got a number. 9.31%, which is the rally in financial stocks since the Trump victory. And the stock market is up about 1.75. And I draw several lessons from this. One is that I and others expected the stock market to take a big slump after the Trump election because we're turning into a banana republic. That was wrong. And so you should not try to predict these things. But the other thing is to focus on the fact that, as we all know in this room, the stock market is not the economy, that people were celebrating the stock market's surge under the Obama administration as if this was an accomplishment. And it's an accomplishment for a very few, for the investor class, but it doesn't have to do with the larger economy. So we should stop focusing on this as a barometer of success or failure.
My number is 1.6 million, which is how much the Secret Service had to pay Donald Trump for use of his airplane during the election. This was
this is a dollar number.
Yeah, $1.6 million. And it was because the idea was that essentially they had to accompany Donald Trump when he was flying around on his private jet, and that cost, and he was allowed to bill them for that service, like as if they were, you know, United Airlines or something. And so it looks like he's going to be able to continue doing this whenever, like, the Secret Service has to accompany his kids or any of his advisors flying on his private jet during the presidency. But we won't know how much he charges because whereas the campaign had to reveal who was paying them what, Trump as president will not. So it's just, well, he'll be able to make some, he has a new revenue stream now, essentially, through his jet.
I'm glad because he says he's not going to be taking the presidential salary, so he needs to get money somehow.
Right? Yep, somehow.
My number is 7.2 million, which is the number of dollars that have been received in donations since the election by the ACLU. 120,000 individual donations have poured into the ACLU, including, well, as we talked about last week, one from me. And this is unprecedented in ACLU history, and this is a welcome and necessary windfall for them. We did ask you, lovely listeners, to tell us what you were doing, and the ACLU came up quite a lot.
Yeah, you guys are awesome, by the way.
We'll get on it, and we will collate all of them and figure out exactly what y'all said. We'll put together a list as promised.
Buy a subscription to a non-fake news organization near you.
Or just, if you want to be able to write it off against taxes, you can always just donate to ProPublica.
It's true.
It's a registered nonprofit.
It's a
good girls
idea.
Need a new pair of shoes.
Well, I think that's it. On the subject of Jesse's daughter's shoes, we will bring this episode of Slate Money to a close. Thank you for listening to us. We do appreciate it. Subscribe, press that little subscribe button. We also have a link to our live show in Brooklyn on December the 15th, which is all going to be all about craft beer. There's literally like 5 tickets left, so jump on that and come drink beer with us at Union Hall in Brooklyn on December the 15th. Thank you very much to Jesse Eisinger, whose article with Justin Elliott about antitrust experts can be found on ProPublica.org. Email address is slatemoney@slate.com. The producer this week is Zach Dinerstein. Executive producers are Steve Lickteig and Andy Bowers. The Panoply Network is at itunes.com/panoply. And we will talk to you next week with a very interesting combination of algorithms and philanthropy with a rather special guest. You're going to like next week. It's going to be good.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.